Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 4, a short chapter which I will entitle The Branch of the Lord. This contains a very famous prophecy of Isaiah, and although the chapter is very short, just 6 verses, it is somewhat difficult, so we'll spend some time on it. We start in verse 1 of Isaiah 4. Isaiah says, "In that day, 7 women will take hold of 1 man and say, 'We will eat our own food and provide our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace.'" Now, this verse 1, it really belongs to the last chapter, chapter 3, because chapter 3 is all about the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 BC. As Ellicott says, the chapter division wrongly separates this verse from the foregoing. The foregoing chapter, chapter 3. This verse comes as the climax of the chastisement of the daughters of Zion, the people of Zion, the people of Jerusalem. Now, we talked about when all this happened in the last chapter. There are some other options. Some people say the days of Ahaz, 732 to 716 BC. John Gill actually puts it in Anno Domini times, AD 70, the time of Vespasian and Titus, the Roman emperors who destroyed Jerusalem. No, we're not going to do that. It says, well, we talked about that in the last chapter. This is the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon in 586 BC. Now, in that day, 7 women will take hold of 1 man and say. Now, 7 is a number that is used often to denote a large, though indefinite, number, as Albert Barnes says. So it just means a whole heap of. A whole bunch of women will take hold of 1 man. Why? Well, so many men had been killed through the destruction of Jerusalem that there were not enough men left to marry the women and give them a family name. So the women are reduced to saying, "We'll eat our own food and provide our own clothes. We won't expect you to take care of us. We just want your family name because we are hopeless. We are disgraced. Take away our disgrace." Now, this is a companion verse to Isaiah 3:6, which says this, "A man will even seize his brother in his father's house, saying, 'You have a cloak, you be our leader. This heap of rubble will be under your control.'" So Isaiah 3:6 says there's not enough men to rule. As the Cambridge commentator says, "The male population are in search of a ruler, the women are in search of a husband, because there's not enough men left to rule, and there's not enough men left to marry." I notice in verse 1, these women take hold of a man. That's in contrast to natural feminine modesty. They grab him, of course, which women normally don't do. They are so concerned to have their disgrace taken away. Take away our disgrace. It was a disgrace in Jewish eyes for a woman to be without a husband and family. Ellicott says that the rabbis even implied that the childlessness was a punishment for sin. So now we go to verse 2. Which contains the famous prophecy of the branch. Isaiah says, "In that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel." Now, we're going to spend some time on this verse. It's a lot more difficult than I thought it would be when I first read it. First of all, we need to see what that phrase, "in that day," means. Well, we've already seen that phrase, "in that day," in verse 1. And in verse 1, it was talking about the destruction of Babylon in 586 BC. But does that refer to the same day in verse 2, "in that day"? Well, if the branch is the Messiah, and I'm going to say that it is, well, then that day can't be the same day. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that "in that day" in verse 2 is the same day as in verse 1, so he puts it back, the branch prophecy, back in the times of the Babylonian judgment, 586 BC. But I don't think so, because in verse 1, the day was characterized by terrible judgment. In that day, there won't be any men left for the women to marry. Judgment. But in verse 2, that day will be, quote-unquote, beautiful and glorious. They seem to be two different days. Now, what day is Isaiah talking about? Well, he's already mentioned the beautiful and glorious day in Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4. "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house," and last days just means in the remote future, the end of the Old Testament era, the beginning of the New Testament era, or it could just mean a long time from now, but I think it means the time of the church, the time of Jesus the Messiah. Isaiah says in Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established at the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will settle disputes among the nations and provide arbitration for many peoples. They will turn their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nations will not take up the sword against other nations, and they will never again train for war. And we said when we were in Isaiah 2 that that passage refers to the new covenant, starting in the time of Jesus and, of course, eventuating in the final state. Now, if Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are correct that this day is referring to 586 BC when the Babylonians came in and destroyed Israel, that means that verse 2 must be talking about the restoration, the return of the exiles from Babylon in 538 BC, and that day will be beautiful and glorious, and good things will happen to Israel. Now, some people hold that view. I don't. Of course, it could be both. It could be that the return from Babylon is a type of the coming of peoples into the church in the New Testament era. Well, let's look at the branch. Now, I have gone through my commentaries and found six possible options. I'm just going to tell you right now, I believe it refers to the Messiah. I think the evidence is pretty strong for that. Let me give you some of the other options before I try to back up the proposition that the branch is the Messiah. Some people say it refers to vegetation. Ellicott denies that. Cambridge actually affirms that. Ellicott says, look, branch is in parallel with the fruit of the land. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. So branch is in parallel with fruit. And branch, by the way, can be translated as growth. Think about it. A branch is a growth of a tree, growth. So in that day, the growth of the Lord will be beautiful, and the fruit of the land will be something of pride and glory. So that's a reasonable solution, I suppose. I don't believe it, but Cambridge thinks so. Here's another option. The branch is the church and the people of Israel. In other words, the believing people of God. As Benson says, quote, those that should be left in the land when it was laid desolate by the Chaldeans should increase into a great people. And of course, the people that are left rebuilt the temple, and then one thing led to another. We go through the Second Temple period, the intertestamentary period. We get to the New Testament, the church is formed, and there's the branch. I don't believe that. Grotius, the famous scholar who is given credit for founding international law, he says that the branch is either Ezra or Nehemiah. I don't think so. A gentleman named Vigilius, quoted in Albert Barnes, says that the branch is the remnant that would return from the Babylonian captivity. GotQuestions.org, a good Protestant commentator website, says that, yes, that's what they think it is. The returnees from Babylon. GotQuestions.org cites Isaiah 60:21 in favor of that. Let me read that. Then all your people will be righteous. They will possess the land forever. They are the branch I planted, the work of my hands, so that I may be glorified. Here's another option. The Jews who return after 586, the returnees, they would spring up with a new spirit. This is quoting a commentator named Michaelis, quoted in Barnes. Well, all of that is very interesting, learned speculation, but we're going to go with the Messiah because almost everybody else does. Ellicott, for example, and Poole, for example. Now, Cambridge does deny that. There are some that deny it, but I believe it's the Messiah. As Ellicott says, acceptance of the term as messianic, acceptance of the term branch as messianic by Jeremiah and Zechariah is surely conclusive, and that's what convinces me, too. I'm going to read you the scriptures where branch is contained, and we'll see Jeremiah and Zechariah obviously are referring to the Messiah. Grotius, who says that the physical reference of the branch is to Ezra or Nehemiah, he says that mystically the reference is to Christ and the Christians. So even he says it's the Messiah, the head, and the Messiah, the body, the Christians. Poole, the commentator, says even the Hebrew doctors said it was the Messiah. So even the Jewish rabbis say it's the Messiah. It's the Messiah, folks. All this other stuff is interesting, but I just don't believe it. I believe it's the Messiah. So in that day, the branch of the Lord, that means the times of the Messiah, the day is the times of the Messiah, will be beautiful and glorious. Now, I told you I'd read you some other scriptures, which will, as Ellicott says, conclusively prove that the branch is referring to the Messiah. Let's start in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 8. Listen, Joshua the high priest, you and your colleagues sitting before you, indeed these men are a sign that I am about to bring my servant the branch. So Joshua the high priest was a type of that who was coming, or that person who was coming, the branch, God's servant. That's Jesus. Zechariah 6:12. You are to tell him, this is what the Lord of hosts says. Here is a man whose name is Branch. He will branch out from his place and build the Lord's temple. The Lord's temple, of course, is the church. The branch is Jesus. Now let's look at two other passages in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 23, verse 5. The days are coming, this is the Lord's declaration, when I will raise up a righteous branch of David. And of course, Jesus was born in the house of David. It's obviously David. He will reign. It's obviously Jesus. He will reign wisely as king and administer justice and righteousness in the land. Of course, that's Jesus. Jeremiah 33, verse 15 says this, in those days and at that time I will cause a righteous branch to sprout up for David, and he will administer justice and righteousness in the land. Clearly referring to Jesus. Now, there's another verse in Isaiah, Isaiah 11, verse 1, which is often cited here. It uses a Hebrew word that's different from branch, but has the same idea. Isaiah 11, 1 says, then a shoot will grow from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Of course, Jesse is David's father. The stump of Jesse means the dynasty of David had been chopped down, which it had been by the Babylonians in 586 BC. But if you'll take stumps and chop them down, you will notice the next year there's a little branch, a little shoot shooting out of the side of the stump to keep the tree alive. I live in the country. I've seen this many times. And so Isaiah 11, verse 1 is talking about Jesus. Now, although the word shoot is different than branch, the thought is the same, as Ellicott says. As Ellicott says this, quote, it will be noted that the prophecy of the branch, tzemach, here comes after a picture of desolation, just as that of the branch, netzer, does in Isaiah 11, 1. So those are your two Hebrew words, tzemach for branch, netzer for branch, for shoot, in Isaiah 11, 1. Ellicott doesn't even use the word shoot. He just translates nets. Ellicott doesn't even use the word shoot in his comment here. He just translates netzer as branch instead of shoot. So we've got a tzemach branch and a netzer branch. It's the same idea. And this shoot will grow from the stump of Jesse. All right. So we've established, I think, that the branch is Jesus. The day that is referred to in verse 2 is the time of Jesus the Messiah. The branch will be beautiful and glorious. That's obviously Jesus. The fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. Now, this is tough. I'm going to take this view that the fruit of the land refers to the temporal and spiritual blessings of the children of God, the Christians, in the times of the Messiah. And that fruit will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel, the survivors referring to the church, the elect. Now, that's not obvious, so we need to look at that a little bit. First of all, fruit. The branch of the Lord will be the fruit of the land. The fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. So the fruit is something that somebody is going to be proud of, an object of pride, if you will. I've found five options for what commentators have said this fruit was. Option number one, the children of righteousness, believers. So we would read it this way. And the believers of the land, or the believers in the church, will be the pride and glory of the survivors, the believers in Israel. The believers are going to be proud of themselves. The believers of the land will be the pride and glory of the believers in Israel. That doesn't make any sense to me, so we're going to scratch that option. The fruit could be the Messiah himself. As the pulpit commentator says, it is argued with reason that the two clauses of this verse are parallel, not antithetical, and that as we understand the one, so we must understand the other. If then the branch is the Messiah, so is the fruit of the earth. Well, I've already decided that the branch is the Messiah, and so if we read these two words, branch and fruit, in parallel with each other, we get this. In that day, the Messiah will be beautiful and glorious, and the Messiah of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. That's reasonable. Cambridge commentary says it's not meant to be symbolic of anything. It's literal fruit. In other words, if you take the branch being the Messiah, he's beautiful, he's glorious. And the literal fruit, the grapes, the pomegranates, the olives, will be a wonderful, wonderful thing that is seen in Israel. Well, again, that interpretation probably goes best with the interpretation that the branch is the survivors of the Babylonian captivity, which I don't believe. And I also don't believe that that fruit is meant to be taken literally. Here's option number four as to what the fruit is. Joseph Benson says that the fruit refers to the spiritual blessings of the gospel. Benson says this, quote, "Frequently described under the emblem of the fruitfulness of the earth and plenty." In other words, the spiritual blessings of the gospel are, quote, "frequently described under the emblems of the fruitfulness of the earth and plenty," the physical being a type of the spiritual. Here's what the pulpit commentator says about this. "Some see in this passage merely a promise that in the messianic times the produce of the soil will become more abundant than ever before, its harvest richer, and its fruitage more luxuriant. But in the light of later prophecy, it is scarcely possible to shut up the meaning within such narrow limits." And that later prophecy, I'm sure the pulpit commentator is referring to Zechariah and Jeremiah, those four passages I just read to you. So, we're not talking about physical fruit here, according to Benson. We're talking about spiritual fruit. So, we would read the passage this way. "In that day, the day of the Messiah of the Lord, who is beautiful and glorious, the spiritual blessings that come from the Messiah will be the pride and glory of the Christians in Israel." And of course, that would have to be referring to the new Israel too, including the Gentiles, the Jews and the Gentiles. Option number four was Benson's option, the spiritual blessings of the gospel, but Poole includes the temporal and spiritual blessings of the gospel, puts them all together. Here's what Poole says, quote, "All temporal blessings, which together with spiritual and eternal blessings, God shall confer upon them, and withal to intimate the fruitfulness of the people, the earth or land being oft put for its inhabitants, in knowledge and grace and all good works." And that's the option I chose. The temporal and spiritual blessings of the land. The land stands for Israel, and of course, the old Israel is a type of the new Israel, the church, will be the pride and glory of the Christians who are in Israel, i.e. the new Israel. All the spiritual and temporal blessings that they experience, and that they indeed produce, because they are in the vine, Jesus. Next, we go to the next noun we've got to investigate, survivors in Israel. I'm going to give you three options here. The survivors could be the elect, the church, and that's the way I've taken it. John Gill says it's those who survived the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and I don't think that's it, because these prophecies of Isaiah, the first 12 chapters, are all about 586 BC and the Babylonians, not the Romans, coming in to destroy Jerusalem. Now, I'm not afraid of AD 70. I'm an Orthodox preterist, and we love AD 70, but I don't think that's what's being referred to here. Third option, the survivors are the remnant who survived the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. As Isaiah said in chapter 1, verse 9, "If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we would be like Sodom. We would resemble Gomorrah." And if you read the book of Jeremiah, of course, there were a few survivors. Jeremiah was among them. They ended up going down to Egypt. But if you take that view that the survivors are the survivors of 586 BC, then verse 2 is not talking about the times of Messiah. It's talking about in that day, which would refer to 586 BC. And so then the branch of the Lord will have to be the returning Jews and not the Messiah. I don't believe that. I believe the survivors in Israel is referring to the believers. Now, of course, it could refer to the survivors of 586, and those survivors are a type of the church showing up in the day of the branch of the Lord in the day of the Messiah. I don't have any problem with that. I really think that to interpret these difficult Old Testament prophets, if you'll take the Old Testament prophecy as a type and Jesus and the church as an antitype, you're going to be right most of the time. Now let's look at the word pride. How you interpret pride is, of course, dependent upon how you interpret the fruit and the branch. But if you take the branch to be the Messiah, and if you take the fruit to be the Messiah, then the Messiah is the pride of the Christians in Israel, the survivors in Israel. But if, on the other hand, you take fruit, as I just did, as being the spiritual fruit of the church, then the church is shown to be a glorious thing. The church has something to be proud of, in the good sense, not the bad sense, by all of its fruit that it produces by being in the branch. Now, let's finish off verse 2 with a reading of six verses which talk about the new Israel, the times of the Messiah, the fruit that is grown in the land, which is all typical of how great it's going to be in the Messianic kingdom. Psalm 72:16, may there be plenty of grain in the land. May it wave on the tops of the mountains. May its crops be like Lebanon. May people flourish in the cities like the grass of the field. Hosea 2:21-22, first part of the verse. On that day I will respond. This is the Lord's declaration. I will respond to the sky, and it will respond to the earth. The earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the oil. Taking this verse backwards, we have grain, new wine, and oil. They need water to grow, so they say to the land, give me some water. The earth says, I don't have any water. So the earth calls to the sky. Sky, I need some water down here. The sky says, I don't have any water. So the sky goes to the Lord and says, please give me some water. And God says, okay. It's kind of a cool way that Hosea did that. But the point is there's going to be new wine and oil in Messianic times. Joel 3:18, in that day the mountains will drip with sweet wine, and the hills will flow with milk. All the streams of Judah will flow with water, and a spring will issue from the Lord's house, watering the valley of Acacias. Mountains will drip with sweet wine. That's because there's so many grapes growing on the mountains. The hills will flow with milk. That's because there's a lot of cattle on those hills that will give you milk, a lot of cows. Lots of water growing the vineyards. The streams of Judah will flow with water. Remember, it's a dry climate, so water's a good thing. The water will make the grapes grow too. Amos 9:13, hear this. The days are coming. This is the Lord's declaration. When the plowman will overtake the reaper and the one who treads grapes. In other words, the harvest from last year's crop is so big that the reapers don't have enough time to cut it down before the plowman for next year's crops comes behind him and says, get out of my way, I'm trying to plant some more crops. The one who treads grapes, same thing. The sower of seeds is going to come right behind him and say, get out of the way, grape treader, I need to plant some more seeds for the vineyard. Too many grapes, too much grain. The mountains will drip with sweet wine and the hills will flow with it. The mountains will drip with wine because of all the vineyards up there and all the grapes. Ezekiel 34:27, the trees of the field will give their fruit, and the land will yield its produce. My flock will be secure in their land. They will know that I am Yahweh when I break the bars of their yoke and rescue them from the hands of those who enslave them. So you got flocks, you got trees, you got fruit trees. Zechariah 9:16-17, the Lord their God will save them on that day as the flock of his people, for they are like jewels in a crown sparkling over his land. How lovely and beautiful they will be. Grain will make the young men flourish, and new wine the young women. So there, again, you have grain and new wine as a symbol of prosperity, and all of this is going to be for us in the new covenant, because that, in my humble opinion, is what the Old Testament prophets were looking forward to, the new covenant church. We go now to Isaiah 4:3. Isaiah continues, those who are left in Zion, who remain in Jerusalem, will be called holy, all who are recorded among the living in Jerusalem. Now, I think here, as far as timing, that we're back in the times of the Babylonian captivity, 586 BC, and I believe that what Isaiah is going to be talking about here is a type of what happens to the church. So, those who are left in Zion, I'm going to give you three options. Option number one is the remnant that came back from Babylon. Poole suggests that option, but Benson absolutely affirms it. He says that's what Isaiah is referring to. Poole says that this remnant that returns would be reformed. They would be different from their fathers. As Benson says, the Jews that survived the Babylonian captivity and returned into their own land were greatly reformed, especially in one point. They relapsed no more into idolatry, and in other respects, also a spirit of religion was revived among them. No idolatry. So those who are left in Zion, according to this option, is the remnant that returned to Zion in 538 BC when the Persians let them loose from the place in Babylon where they were held captive before the Persians captured the Babylonians. Now, here's option number two, those who are left in Zion. Poole suggests this option, that this refers to Christians who believe in the Messiah. They would be left, whereas the great mass of Jews in Jerusalem would be destroyed. Those who are left in Zion, and of course Zion is often used to symbolize the church, and they would be left in Zion. That would have happened in AD 70 when the unbelieving Jews are wiped out, leaving the believing Christian Jews. Now, Benson affirms what I also believe, that Both of these are true. Those who are left in Zion refers to the returning remnant from Babylon in 538 BC, and those returnees are a type of the antitype, which is believers flowing into the church in the new Zion, as Benson states. But the prophecy was much more eminently fulfilled in the first converts from Judaism to Christianity, to whose purity and holiness the apostles often bear witness, and of which they glory in their writings. So these returnees will be called holy because they got rid of their idols. Those coming into the church in the times of Messiah, they're going to be called holy because they'll be saints of God. And of course, a saint is just another word for a holy person. All of these were recorded among the living in Jerusalem, and that literally could refer to the registers, the books that the Jews had back then. As Barnes says, the Jews customarily recorded all the names of the people in a register. If you were written in the book in this register, you were alive. But if you died, your name was stricken. But remember, in Revelation, our names can never be stricken from the book of life. So that could be a literal reference there. The returnees are recorded among the living in Jerusalem because they're still living. They returned. But of course, I believe that's a type also of the Christians who are now living in the New Jerusalem, which is the church of Jesus Christ. One last point before we leave verse 3. We need to look at the word Zion, which I've mentioned many, many times in these podcasts. Those who are left in Zion physically. Zion, of course, refers to either the city of David, a part of Jerusalem, or the city of David plus Mount Moriah, where the Temple Mount is, or the whole city of Jerusalem, or the whole southern kingdom of Judah, or the whole nation of Israel, north and south kingdom. But, of course, the metaphorical reference of Zion is more important to us because it refers to the church, as Ellicott affirms. We read in Hebrews 12:22, "Instead, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to myriads of angels in festive gathering." The author of Hebrews is writing to Hebrew Christians. He says, you've come to Mount Zion, so he's not talking about coming to a physical mountain in Jerusalem. He's talking about the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, which we know is the Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven in the book of Revelation, which we know is the heavenly Jerusalem, the Jerusalem which comes down out of heaven in the book of Revelation. It's the church. Now, of course, according to my interpretation, according to Ellicott's interpretation, this Zion here has two references. The typical reference, those who are left in Jerusalem, those who remain in Jerusalem, as Isaiah says in verse 3, those are a type of those who are left in the church. And left in the church means, of course, in the church, left to be delivered as the rest of physical Zion is destroyed in AD 70. We go now to verses 4 through 6, and we will finish our discussion of Isaiah 4. Isaiah says the Lord will wash away the filth of the women of Zion. He will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire. Then the Lord will create over all of Mount Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day and a cloud of flaming fire by night. Over all the glory will be a canopy. It will be a shelter and shade from the heat of the day and a refuge and hiding place from the storm and rain. Now these women of Zion, who are they? Well, remember, Zion can either refer to Jerusalem, B.C. 586, or it could refer to the women in the church, or both, and I believe it's both. The Lord will wash away the filth of the returning women to Zion, so they will not be proud and haughty, as they were described in chapter 3. I'll read you that passage in just a minute to show how evil the women were. So the returning Jewish women are clean, their filth having been washed away, but also the women who come into the church, they have their sins taken away. Isaiah has already said that those in Zion will be called holy in verse 3. In verse 3, Isaiah says those who are left in Zion will be called holy. And so now he's talking about how they're going to get holy. They're going to get judged. And that's how holiness occurs. Judgment occurs so that sin can be purged and burn up. Judgment has got to be done for holiness to appear. Now, one might ask this question, why does Isaiah single out the women? The Lord will wash away the filth of the women in Zion. Why did he just say the Lord will wash away the filth of the people living in Zion? Barnes says this, it is not departing from the spirit of this passage to remark that the church is purified and true religion is often promoted by God's humbling the pride and vanity of females. Mr. Barnes was writing in the mid-19th century in America. But he sounds like he's in the red pill movement of today, as people are getting really upset by feminists these days, men especially. Toxic femininity is being matched by toxic masculinity, unfortunately. Well, let's rescue Barnes from a charge of male chauvinism. Isaiah has already singled out the high-born women of Jerusalem as being especially evil. In the last chapter, Isaiah 3, verses 16 through 24, I'm going to read this for you. The Lord also says, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, walking with heads held high and seductive eyes, going along with prancing steps, jingling their ankle bracelets, the Lord will put scabs on the heads of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will shave their foreheads bare. On that day, the Lord will strip their finery, ankle bracelets, headbands, crescents, pendants, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle jewelry, sashes, perfume bottles, amulets, signet rings, nose rings, festive robes, capes, cloaks, purses, garments, linen clothes, turbans, and veils. What a sentence. Instead of perfume, there will be a stench. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of beautifully styled hair, baldness. Instead of fine clothes, sackcloth. Instead of beauty, branding. They're going to be branded like slaves. Well, obviously, the women were a big problem right before 586 B.C., and Isaiah let them hold it. This reminds me of that old ancient or medieval theological saying, the corruption of the best is the worst. Women are the best. They're wonderful when they're good, but boy, when they're bad, they're really bad. So, in verse 4, Isaiah continues, God will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem. That means all the people that were killed there. I assume he means all the people who were killed unrighteously there by the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Before 586 B.C., Isaiah says this cleansing will happen by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire. The judgment would be judgment on Jerusalem in 586 B.C., and a spirit of fire. That's a perfect reference to the burning of the city of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. They did. They burned it to the ground. And verse 5, then, that means after the destruction, after the judgment, when the people return and reestablish Israel, reestablish Zion, then the Lord will create over all of Mount Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day and a glow of flaming fire by night. Now, this is a reference to the pillar of cloud, the cloud of smoke, the pillar of cloud, and the Shekinah glory that led the children of Israel through the wilderness on the Exodus. Not only did the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire lead the Israelites, but they protected the Israelites. In the daytime, they had a cloud over them to get the sun off their backs. At night, the fire, the Shekinah glory glowed so that they could see anything attacking them. And so this is a perfect symbol of how God's going to protect his reformed and redeemed people, both literally referring to the returnees from Babylon and antitypically referring to the church of Jesus Christ. We're going to be protected. Overall, the glory will be like a canopy. The Shekinah glory will be like a canopy. Canopy is something that protects you from the sun and the rain. Verse 6, it, this canopy, will be a shelter and shade for the heat of the day, and a refuge and hiding place from the storm and the rain. So in other words, nothing's going to get you. Not the heat by day, and not the storm and the rain in the daytime either. Nothing's going to get you because you're going to be perfectly protected. Now notice Isaiah is using events on the Exodus to use as a symbol for protection of the returnees. And he's not using these symbols, the pillar of cloud, the pillar of smoke, the pillar of flaming fire, the canopy. Those were not symbols that were in existence at the time of 586, and that makes me a little bit more comfortable as referring those symbols even further ahead to the days of the Messiah. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished discussing Isaiah chapter 4. I want to summarize this chapter by going back and reading you, paraphrasing verse 2, the famous verse that contains the branch of the Lord, because I believe that so much discussion will get us deep into the trees, but sometimes we'll lose sight of the forest. And that day, the day of the Messiah of the Lord, will be beautiful and glorious. And the fruit from Messiah's church in the land, or in the church, will be the pride and glory of the church in the new Israel. I really believe that's what Isaiah was prophesying. That means that you and I are the objects of prophecy. The fruit that we produce will be the pride and glory of the church. And in our day, Jesus, the branch of the Lord, will be beautiful and glorious. We need to keep that in mind as we read the internet about the degradation and corruption of our human society. It doesn't matter, because we are protected by the branch of the Lord, Jesus Christ, the beautiful and glorious Jesus Christ. He will be a shade over our head, a canopy over our head, protecting us from heat and storms and rain. On that happy note, we are now finished with Isaiah chapter 4, and we are ready to go to Isaiah chapter 5 in our next audio, which I will entitle The Vineyard of the Lord is Destroyed. That, of course, will refer to Israel, not us. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.